This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names, a mystery beyond all naming. This morning we are here in celebration of, among other things, fathers. Some of us have negative images of what fathers can be because some of us have had lousy fathers. Others see fatherhood in a positive light because their personal experiences are positive. In some sense, many of us wish, as my wife Viv does, that we all had Atticus Finch as our father. Harper Lee's image of fatherhood, as portrayed by Gregory Peck in the Oscar-winning Christmas Day 1962 release, still brings pangs of envy. If only we could have been that way with our kids. But more than simply parenting, we are talking this morning about husbanding. The ability to spend or use economically, or simply the ability to live gracefully without a lot of fuss. This world and the harbingers of news don't want us to imagine that anything is easy. The world speaks in the language of labor. Count, if you will, how many times people tell you how hard something is going to be once you announce you're going to do it, and with what difficulty something may be accomplished. There's a bit of self-fulfilling negativity there. Think instead of the watercourse way, the fact that water effortlessly finds its own level. Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching suggests that we take the watercourse way, that we flow into life, giving where giving seems appropriate and receiving when things come our way. I'm thinking of the scene in To Kill a Mockingbird where Atticus Finch finds the town drunk harassing Atticus's children who are waiting for him in the car. Atticus comes out of the house where he's been visiting and simply approaches the car. The town drunk spews vitriolic profanities at Atticus, but Atticus never responds, never lashes out at the man. Atticus knows that it is his presence alone that is making the statement that needs to be made. He is his children's father, and his economy causes the drunk to slither off away from them. We pray this morning for the good sense and certitude to know that we are doing what needs to be done by simply suiting up and showing up. There's an art to life that isn't often taught and isn't often recognized. Give us the insight to see those artists of life that don't fit the mold of society, those pushed toward the periphery because they don't match definitions of success and worldly honor. Mostly this morning we search for an economy of being. May we forgive ourselves when we use a hammer when a thumbtack would have done the trick. Great Spirit, give us the power to know that more often than not we know from the inside what needs to be done and what needs to be ignored. Minding the breath, minding our heartbeats, let us move through this life like the guests we are, honoring the earth and all sentient beings that inhabit us. We pray this in the name of everything that is holy, and that is precisely everything. Amen.
Good morning. My name's Monty Newton. I've been coming here about 14 years. Came here on a date. And I married her, Nell. And she's gone home. She's a lifelong Unitarian, and so are our children, 10 and 8, Lulu and Henry. And we're quite happy here. I was exchanging emails with Jack, and we were talking about hermits. And a little louder. Oh, okay. We were talking about hermits, and I just fired off this little bit about a hermit in my hometown. And Jack emailed me back. He says, "You're going to have to read that on Father's Day." Okay. And it's pretty much what I wrote him. I've sort of cleaned it up a little bit. I wore my Johnny Cash jacket, too, just for the occasion. I'm from a little small cotton farm in town up around Lubbock. It's called Anton. It's about 1,200 people. And they're pretty typical, and there's always a character in the town who doesn't live like everybody else, and they're usually crazy. That's what everybody says. Okay, there is a hermit sort in my hometown. His name is Roosevelt Williams. He's an African-American fellow in his 70s or 80s. He's always been there. My mother's 75, and she remembers him when she was a little girl. So everyone says he's crazy. And all my life I'd heard that he'd been in prison, that he had murdered someone, that you got to watch him. He carries a switchblade, and he's probably on dope. He has no electricity. He has a little tar paper shack, about 8x10 house, I guess. He uses an outhouse, his plumbing's water hose in the yard. He's decorated that little tar paper shack with license plates, mirrors, signs, reflectors, whirligigs, flags. Eventually, I was able to see that little house as an interesting example of folk art. But to everybody you talk to in Anton, it just means he's crazy. I've been around him from time to time all my life. One summer, we hoed cotton for several weeks, so we never spoke. Once I asked him how old he was, which is really not a very good lead-in question. I mean, I was only about 12, and he shrugged, and he said, "Oh, about 40. And I thought, well, he is crazy. He doesn't know how old he is. He didn't say 42, you know. That's what everybody told me. He rides a bike. He's got it decorated up. He's got flags, tassels. He's got a motorcycle windshield on it. He wears his long underwear year-round. He's always got a coat on. His head's covered in a red scarf. He has a tree in front of his house. He waters it. It keeps his bird feeder full. I have an uncle that employs him on odd jobs from time to time, kind of looks after him. He won't accept charity, but he will pick up work when he can. A few years ago, I was in town, and he was standing outside a store, looking at the ground, avoiding eye contact, like he always does. And just on a whim, I said, "Hey, Roosevelt, how you doing?" And he slowly looked up at me, and he broke into this big smile, and he was about the friendliest guy I've met, talked to in that town in years. He talked to me about his brother. His brother was in my class. He was a football star. Talked about the weather, made small talk about some barking dogs in the neighborhood. He told a humorous story about my grandfather, and he was very sorry to hear my dad had passed. He was very friendly and polite for no particular reason. And one thing I know about small towns is people can be very mean to outsiders. And he's an outsider, even though he's been there all his life. They can even be mean to me because I grew up there, but I left. But I realized at that moment that he is and always has been a mirror. He reflects back what you give him. If you glare at him and think, "Crazy bum," he just glares back and reinforces that. If you're friendly, he's friendly. His front door has a mirror on it. And if you approach the door, the first thing you see is yourself, which I thought that's pretty clever. I don't know what it's supposed to be. Maybe it's to ward off evil spirits. I think it works. I thought he was a street guy with mental illness, autistic, all that. It was all my projection. I had no basis in that other than that's what everybody told me, that he was crazy. I once asked another older guy, black fellow in his neighborhood, about him, and he said, "Roosevelt lives in his own world. And with the way the world is now, I just don't find that so strange. He came of age during segregation and days of lynchings. Living in his own world was probably a sensible survival technique and has served him well." Now, my uncle told me he likes music, and he has a tape player, so I bring in batteries for his tape player and cassette tapes. We have similar tastes in music. He likes Hank Williams and Ray Charles. He also likes birds, and the birds like him. He probably has the only bird feeder in town. I asked him why he likes birds, and he said, because they can fly, and I sure wish I could. There's no telling what kind of life he's lived. He's kept it to himself, but he kept his dignity and his humanity close and safe. He is without a doubt the most interesting person in that town. Thank you.
I'm going to make a few comments before I start in on the sermon. This time last week, last Sunday, I was fording the Colorado River on a full-bred Arabian horse named Prince. And the amazing thing was that my wrangler was a 93-year-old woman who owned the ranch. My sister's saddle started to come off, and this woman jumped off her horse and cinched that saddle back up. I said, "Let me do that for you." And she said, "No." And she did it herself. I would have been in Colorado until Thursday, but my wife underwent an emergency appendectomy operation, as she reminded me, does anybody ever have elective appendectomy surgery? But Monday night she had her appendix out, and I was at her bedside by 1:30 that morning, 5 hours after the operation. I didn't come back for her. I came back because nobody could feed our 7 dogs. Kent Samuelson tried to get in the house, but one of the dogs kept barking and peeing on the floor, so he left. But I wanted to thank Janice, Kent, and Sky Samuelson for all their help, and I want to thank everybody in this church who saw to my wife's healing and helped her through her difficult time. I coddled her for 2 days, but she couldn't stand it after that, and she took the car and went shopping yesterday, garage sailing, I should say. She never shops retail. And she's here this morning. I sure am grateful she's alive and well. The first reading is from Cormac McCarthy. It's the only reading, actually. He received the Pulitzer this year, and this is from his first book, The Orchard Keeper. He came out on a high, bald knoll that looked over the valley, and he stopped here and studied it as a man might cresting a hill and seeing a strange landscape for the first time. Pines and cedars in a swatch of dark green piled down the mountain to the left and ceased again where the road cut through. Beyond that, a field and a log hog pen, the shakes spilling down the broken roof, looking like some diminutive settler's cabin in ruins. Through the leaves of the hardwoods, he could see the zinc-colored roof of the church faintly coruscant, and a patch of bordered siding weathered the paper gray of a wasp nest. And far in the distance, the long purple welts of the Great Smokies. If I was a younger man, he told himself, I would move to them mountains. I would find me a Clearwater branch and build me a log house with a fireplace. And my bees would make Black Mountain honey, and I wouldn't care for no man. He started down the steep incline. Then I wouldn't be unneighborly either, he added. I brought a statue today that my wife bought in an estate sale. It's a Japanese man that's carrying twigs. That's his job. And he's also reading a book. Now, we heard from Monty Newton, our worship associate, and you may be asking yourself, what does a seemingly misanthropic old black man have to do with Father's Day? That's a good question, and if it's not answered after this service, see me in the foyer. Something I've noticed through the years, men like to isolate. You ever notice that? Yes, it's true, men do have friends, but how many men do you know who have kept in touch with those friends throughout the years? Monty answered that after the service. He still writes a guy who was in his first grade class. That's pretty unusual. And even if they do have friends, what are friends for with men? Do men call each other and complain about their kids? Do men commiserate when they aren't getting along with their wives? What exactly is the role of friends when it comes to men? I'm not pretending to know the answers to these and other questions about men. After all, I'm a man, and it goes without saying almost that I'm writing this sermon in order to learn something about myself and other men. Recently, I got a questionnaire from a parishioner here in this church, and the questions all concerned my role as a father, a parent. The questions were good, but to tell the truth, all I could do was write this lady back an email and say I had been a failure as a father. When my son was 3 years old, I left he and his mother, and When the papers came for him to be adopted, all I could think of was I didn't have to pay child support anymore. I went down to that lawyer's office and signed that paper real quick. When my daughter was 10 years old, I left she and her mother, my second wife. A few years later, I had my daughter for a couple of summers. But when the third summer rolled around, my daughter chose a new set of tires over coming to see me in Dallas. How'd I feel about that? Well, I didn't think she should make that choice. It was my summer, and whether my daughter needed new tires on her car or not, I thought she owed me that summer, right? But in the end, I did nothing more than complain. Viv and I didn't see Isabel that summer, and it was a relief. The first summer she came, I spent the whole summer running between my daughter and my wife saying, "Is everything okay? Is everything okay?" And finally, they sat me down and said, "Would you stop that?" I was trying to fix something that wasn't broken, but who knew? Certainly not me. I'm 60 years old, and to me, women might as well be a different species. Yes, I get along with my wife, all three of them, my sister and her friends, the female parishioners in this church, but the concerns of women are not the concerns of men. Women are from Venus, men are from Mars, as the book title reads, and even though I haven't read the book, the title seems perfectly clear to me. Lawrence Durrell, the British novelist and poet, once said concerning the Mona Lisa that, quote, "She has the look of a woman who has just dined off her husband." And even when reading that quote, I'm not quite sure. Could that be a good thing? Eric Byrne, the psychiatrist, is reported to have said, "No husband is a hero to his wife's psychiatrist." Since husbands are more often than not men, perhaps it would behoove us to take a look at some famous quotes about men. Mark Twain first. He wrote, "The noblest work of God, man." Who discovered this? Man. Twain again. "Man is the only animal who blushes, or needs to." And finally, Twain, during his Letters from the Earth phase, "Man is a museum of diseases, a home of impurities. He comes today and is gone tomorrow. He begins as dirt and departs as stench." Perhaps you think that last bit is too harsh. Perhaps Mark Twain's closeness to the subject has made it impossible for him to be objective at that point in his life. After all, familiarity does breed contempt. But Twain himself added to that old adage, "Familiarity breeds contempt and children." But it's another definition of husbands I'd like us to look at today. We've been dealing with the meaning of a husband as in a woman's spouse, the man to whom a woman is married. But there's also the transitive verb, to husband. The meaning of the verb is to be thrifty with something, to use something economically and sensibly. What would it mean in the wedding ceremony if when I pronounced the couple husband and wife, it was this definition of husband that was being thought through? What would marriages be if the job of one of the partners was making sure that what was used by the couple was used in an economic, sensible, and thrifty manner? And it is these ideas of thrift, sensibility, and economy that lead quite easily into our discussion of the hermit. When we become overwhelmed by the world and our lives seem to be nothing more than one continuous activity, it might just be that it's time for a retreat. Sometimes these retreats are religious or spiritual in nature. Siddhartha Gautama Buddha abandoned his family and went on a spiritual quest, and his wife didn't even send the county sheriff after him for a non-payment of child support. The nature of this quest was the discovery that outside the walls of Buddha's father's castle, the rest of the world was lost in suffering. In truth, the very foundation of Buddhism is the fact that suffering is universal, and if humankind is to persevere in this life, they must deal with this suffering. It's unavoidable. To live this life, one must not ignore it, push it out of consciousness, nor pretend that it is not the ultimate fate of all who live. Everything we see that is living will die. The solution to this problem is the very nature of how the Buddha saw the self. If it is true that we all suffer, then who is it that is suffering? Buddha discovered that there is no permanent self, and this discovery led him inexorably to the conclusion that even though suffering happens, It is made worse when this suffering happens to somebody. If, in fact, the lights are on but nobody's home, then suffering is still present. But the self that keeps score, the self that knows it's being wronged, the self that holds grudges, the self that wants revenge, this self is an illusion. Suffering is what it is. Take note of it and move on. Taking note of it and moving on is what is often defined as enlightenment. If there is no self, then scores aren't kept. Wrongs don't need to be righted. Grudges become moot, and revenge becomes the boomerang that doesn't come back. The Chinese Book of Changes, the I Ching, counsels us thusly: the wise person rises above the inferior person. The wise person is like the sky above the mountain. No matter how high the mountain is, it can never touch the sky. The wise person keeps their distance because the mountain can never reach them, neither in a physical or a psychological sense. The wise person's retreat is never motivated by anger or hatred, but by simple dignity. The image of the lake is also used in Asian philosophy. Everything is reflected in the lake, in a calm lake, but nothing is held there. The moon is reflected perfectly in the lake, but if we jump into the lake in order to get to the moon, all it will afford us is a bath. The forest fire is reflected there, but the water is never burning. Now we seem to be returning to Monty Newton's story of Roosevelt, the man with a mirror for a front door. Those who live in Atten, outside of Lubbock, might think it's quaint for Roosevelt to have a mirror for a front door, and perhaps even Roosevelt thinks nothing more of it than it's convenient. But on a deeper philosophical level, as Monty said, the person who approaches Roosevelt's house will see themselves reflected before they see Roosevelt. In much the same way, Roosevelt himself is nothing more than a calm lake, a clean mirror. If you approach him with fear and trembling, it is fear and trembling that will be returned to you. But if, like Monty, you approach him as a man among men, then he will miraculously respond in kind. Imagine that. Perhaps then it isn't a question of either being a husband or a hermit. Perhaps the real deal is in being a husband in the sense of someone who is cautious and economical in their dealings with the world. Then it follows quite naturally that drawing back, retreating, abandoning the fight when, if in reality it's nothing more than a fight between entities that don't exist, then perhaps the paradox between either being a husband or a hermit is resolved or held maybe in a state of suspended animation. The tarot deck has as its one of its major arcana the card known as the Hermit. The manner in which this card is displayed in the Waite Rider deck is much like the manner in which saints are displayed. He's wearing a monk's hood. He carries with him a staff and a lantern. He's not a beggar, nor one who seeks only isolation. His long white beard, staff, and lantern suggest he is out and about in the world, not lost in idleness, nor seeking only isolation. The lantern is the light of the world shed precisely for the enlightenment of others. The hermit is a sage, not simply searching for truth and justice, but bringing truth and justice to the people. He's like the fool in the major arcana. He will go to all lengths, walk to the edge, but unlike the fool, he knows his boundaries, will not step over the precipice. He's not on an adventure, but walking about the world in hope of spreading light to those who need it. The hermit is an unsettling image for us in the West. They're outside the context of daily living, not worried about the kids nor the soccer game. He's not subordinated to the authority of the age. He is, in fact, modeling for the rest of the world. And this modeling can lead to his being ostracized and scapegoated by the culture within which he lives, but quite amicably refuses to take part in. Hence, the image of Roosevelt, a black man who lives off the fat of the land, the man who shows the rest of Atten that the rules and constrictions of the society in which he lived may not be as solid as they would like to believe. On some level, we all wish to be comforted by the societal rules by which we play, but the truth is, these rules are arbitrary and potentially meaningless. We are reminded of that when there lives one among us who ignores the rules and not only gets by, but in a deeper sense, flourishes. The The morality of the wandering hermit tells us that what is right and wrong is right and wrong and knows no place and time. We wish there were answers to life's big questions. Are men hermits? Are they husbands? What's the truth of our being? The poet Rainer Maria Rilke wrote, "Try to love the questions themselves. Live the questions now. Perhaps then, someday, far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into the answers." And yet we should not expect the world to always understand what we're up to. Even with the best of intentions, we who would be husbands, persons who would use judiciously those things which the world has entrusted us with, we husbands must not expect the world or those in it to realize what we may be up to or accept what we think we have to offer. I will close with a story which illustrates this point perfectly. There was once a farmer, a man who husbanded the land, who kept his fields completely to himself. His crops were his main interest, and he prided himself in keeping the birds and animals away. He built fences around about and didn't even like the idea that when he harvested, he might be leaving the least little bit for the field mice and other scavengers. Then one day he got sick and almost died. When he recovered, he was a changed man. He realized now he was lonely. He'd been so successful in his efforts to keep those at bay that he wanted at bay that although he was a rich man, there was a space here in the middle of his chest that could not be filled. In a flash, he realizes he needed other beings. Immediately, he went out, took down the fences that surrounded his fields. He walked into the fields and stood there with his arms outstretched to receive in loving kindness all who would now visit him. He stood there night and day, his arms opened in love. Much to his surprise, no animals came to eat his crops. No birds landed to enjoy his grains. You see, the truth was, they were all terrified of the farmer's new scarecrow.